A lot of the vehicles that they had when you were older than the Canadian forces, these guys had museum pieces.
But why were Albanian Kosovar refugees going into Albania? Like, what were they fleeing from? Just the general fighting on the front? Or
once the fighting started, I mean, it became this flood out. No one's quite, I mean, were they forced out at gunpoint for the way that it was claimed? I mean, not all of them left. I was in Pristina. There was still a whole whack of Albanians still living there. The house where I stayed was an Albanian guy's house. Upstairs was a policeman and a soldier. And in those days, those two guys had to pack their vehicles and take their family and leave. And there was no, I mean, they weren't shooting him or vice versa. It wasn't, I mean, we saw it firsthand. They were still there. In fact, the Uchika, the KLA, were open for business the minute NATO showed up. The brigade that was inside Pristina, and I got to meet the guy. They just killed a servant in the streets, and we got to have an interview with him. I've still got the red armband they gave me. And they were, I mean, openly open for business the minute they showed up, but they've been operating the whole time. They killed the police chief on the streets, the servant police chief, at some point during the fighting. So they still had, I mean, the servant didn't have the complete control. Indicate.
Scott, I wonder if I can ask a question closer to home. I was engaged with that interaction you were having with the lawyer at the end of the table. We just went through an election in Canada on issues around Gumry inquiry, ethics. Some time ago, I saw Rear Admiral Vice Admiral Buck speak to the Senate Review Committee on recruiting of 5,000 troops, and he said it couldn't be done. Now we have General Hillier speaking, saying, yes, it can be done. Then I know that the Atlantic region of recruiting is the only one that meets its quota in Canada.
Right.
And I think, you know, some time ago, it wasn't that long ago that a Commodore on the West Coast was associated with a court-martial with computers and pornography and stuff like that. How much can we believe of our own government and what we're hearing out of national defense on what they can do and what they can't do? And how much of it's getting, what's your impression of how many words get spun or twisted to suit executives' positions in Ottawa?
It was actually on Tuesday. I attended this thing in Ottawa. General Hillier had a big rally, if you call it that. I mean, it was this huge show of strength for himself and for the department. And what's interesting was the timing, because, of course, outgoing Defense Minister Graham is just cleaning out his office. And there's nobody appointed as Minister of Defense under the Conservatives yet. So he had this window, this 5-6 day window, where he's got no political master. And immediately he stages this event, ostensibly to announce the standing up of four new headquarter commands. But in reality, he was basically out there trying to fix the new government's feet to the floor, I mean, to follow the path that he's going in, which is sort of a dangerous course for a general to take. Now, one of the things that came up, questions afterwards to him, was exactly about this ability to recruit these numbers. It's 13,000 regular and 10,000 more reservists. Under the Liberals, it was 5,000 regulars, 3,000 reservists, right? So some journalist said to him, well, General, I mean, because he said, I can do that, no problem. He said, well, why is it you couldn't recruit 8, and now you can recruit 23? How are you able to do that? And he just, well, he said, well, it's all about money. If we've got the money, we can do it, can do. That's not true. You can't just bring that many people into an organization which is so under strength now and over deployed. You've got those guys in Afghanistan now, 2,200. You're not going to put the sick, lame, and lazy, as we called them, I mean, out into the field. You're going to put your best, your brightest. The guys that you, exact guys you'd want to be instructors on a training cadre, if you're going to bring recruits off the street, well, they're already deployed. And that's the problem. They can't bring in, even if they went out tomorrow and used press gangs to put people in, who the hell's going to train them? And where's the uniforms and the things that are going to come up behind that? And unlike, I mean, last century, where we could do things very quickly, from now on, I mean, everyone's saying it takes 3 years to get uniforms, and even before they had electronic sewing machines, I mean, they were able to produce all kinds of uniforms for guys. Sure, the boots fell apart, but they were able to make 10,000. So now we've got a different mindset in there, and his ability, I think, for Hillier to politically switch his stripes. I mean, he didn't challenge the Liberals. He didn't say, look, you want me to recruit 8,000, you're not giving me the money. He never came out and said that. He just went along with it, not recruiting them and not achieving that goal. Now he's been given a goal of acquiring 23,000 more.
And I quite clearly heard Rear Admiral Buck tell the Senate Review Committee
the 8,000 was dreaming and technical.
5,000.
His phrase was must
was
be dreaming and technical.
With given whatever resources they threw into it.
And that's why Buck's not the defender, exactly. The chief of defense. Then.
Yeah.
He got nailed. He said
so. Yeah. My question then is how much do we actually believe then that comes out of our own defense department?
Well, then the government's going to find someone else who dreams in that same technical.
Right.
As long as we're on the same page. No one really cares whether we recruit 20. I mean, that's a huge number.
Yeah.
23,000.
Scott, I'd like to follow up on Dan Millis's subject. Why is it in Canada there's such a dearth of knowledgeable expert defense commentators? You know, we followed your career.
That's because you're not writing enough, Alex.
And I can name one or two other people who know a bit about some fields, but really, why in Canada don't newspapers have people who know what's going on in defense and security and can comment on it?
Well, Ken West, I mean, they've got Dave Puglisi, who's been doing it for a long time, and he's damn good at it. I would think, beyond a doubt, the best that there is, and he knows the personalities, he knows the issues, understands it very well, and as a result, the Defense Department hates him. They know that he's not going to be buffaloed by their crap. I mean, he's going to go through there. And others that are supposed to pay attention to it for various other chains do it on an occasional basis and then can be easily snowed by public affairs officers who have that agenda. They want to put things forward. And at this thing the other day, this rally, one of the first things I noticed was that there was a smattering of brown berets in the audience. And this is the first time that they're putting these guys out there. This is the new Special Operations Regiment, CSAOR. Yeah, so we're going to have 750 Special Forces troops that are air mobile stationed in Petawawa. And Hillier started putting this thing together. I think it was mid-December, if I'm not mistaken. We got the Canfor Gen, which outlined how it's all going to come together. And it says rush, rush, rush. And they're already starting to assemble. They're taking the best from the other units. They're not recruiting these guys. They're bringing them in, leaving the line units, of course, without their best and the brightest. And the best of the best go to the JTF too. We're creating all these different tiers, which you can question the rationale behind that. But that being said, stories were done. Dave Puglisi did a story on the new regiment. It was out there. It was floating around in Ottawa, of all places, front page story. Another competing agency, who's the supposed defense reporter, when the guy walks through the door, she goes, oh, that's a nice color beret. I mean, where do I get one? And finally gets explained to her that this guy's actually part of a new regiment. Her story was, I mean, 6 weeks later, following the thing, how we've got this new secret regiment. It's only secret because she wasn't paying attention. I mean, it was out there. So yeah, you've got a question. I question my colleagues and peers, and it's much easier for them to buffalo someone who's just coming out of journalism school tomorrow.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is the title of your talk could have been From the First Gulf War to Baghdad, How the Uncorrupted Media Lies Led to the U.S. Fiasco. And I think of Bush Sr.
Doesn't rhyme as good.
Bush.
Well, good to Baghdad. It's
Bush Sr. arranged for, just before the First Gulf War, arranged for the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter to testify. She was, you know, her identity was disguised, which is a congressional hearing. She gave the story that there were Iraqis who had gone into Kuwait and had taken babies out of incubators. And, you know, this was, you know, a sob story that was given out to the American people, you know, to drum up support for an invasion of Iraq. And the other one was the United States military had said that there was 100% interception rate between the Patriot missiles and Iraqi Scud missiles. Well, Dr. Ted Postol at MIT showed that there was no interception. It was a total failure. But my question is, I'm wondering if you can speak to other NATO atrocities in the former Yugoslavia, particularly the United States military using depleted uranium.
Well, that's something which they still say the jury's out on, depleted uranium. I mean, there's obviously enough evidence after the first Gulf War, all those American soldiers coming home sick, and they said, well, either it's going to be depleted uranium or it's the anthrax vaccine. We're not sure which, but people were questioning what it was that made all these guys sick. And one of my first trips in, August 2000, one of the things that I wanted to find out was, why doesn't someone ask the Iraqis? I mean, they were exposed to this stuff too, and they didn't get the vaccine. So you can eliminate one if they're all healthy, right? But they weren't healthy. You had all kinds of birth defects down around Basra, and where the areas of greatest impact were horrific congenital deformities. I mean, it's unbelievable the things that you'd see down there that happened to those people as a result of being exposed to whatever it was they were exposed. I don't know whether it's, I mean, I'm not a scientist. And people say, well, yeah, it's all new science. Of course it is. Nobody thought to take depleted uranium before and then use it as a weapon and explode this mildly radioactive material, which then incinerates itself. I mean, from a weapons point of view, it's fantastic. It can punch through the best armor, and then it ignites and it fries the crew inside. I mean, it's well done, but no one thought what's going to happen after this thing goes off. Some of it was used in Kosovo and in Bosnia. We've had soldiers come back sick. There was questions raised about, you know, Bosnia syndrome or Balkan syndrome. It always seems to flare up and then disappear. And in fact, and I'm jumping ahead here, but there was supposed to be a major survey done within the Canadian forces about the environmental illnesses that they've suffered in Croatia, etc. So many of them came back sick. And it had gone its course through the health branch, and the ombudsman, the old ombudsman, had initiated a full-scale survey, and the new ombudsman has now just shut the thing down. So that story should break in a couple of days, if not tomorrow. But anyway, again, it's unfortunate because no one's getting to the bottom of it. I think a lot of people don't want to get to the bottom of it, but I have a personal interest I should mention. I was in Kuwait on Death Highway, exposed to that stuff with our engineers in 91, and my own son had a birth defect similar to what they have there. So, I mean, I've gone through that, seeing those kids in the hospital. I mean, I was through all that. If he was in Iraq, he would have died. His throat was not joined to his stomach, and that's one of the things which is, I think in Canada, like 1 in 6,000, but out of the troops that came back, I think we had 6 from one unit of 18 had a similar thing happen to their kids. So I don't know, but I do feel personally affected by it, and I do want to get to the bottom of it. It's just that there's not a whole lot we can do. Yeah.
Yes, I'm just one thing I ask out of more personal interest than anything else. I know that traditionally in the past, Canadian forces, especially in the Navy, when we go on NATO cruises, we have very much a sterling reputation when we go into other countries as opposed to, well, especially the Americans. People tend to have a very high view of us as opposed to Americans. Now, in your experience, when you've gone into like all the Balkans and you've gone to Iraq and whatnot, I mean, do Canadians who are on the ground there, do they have the same sterling reputation amongst the locals in those areas as they do, say, in the naval environment?
Normally they do. I mean, they certainly earned a great reputation in the Balkans as being fair and impartial. And one of the problems, I mean, the Canadians have a different level of professionals. There's no question about it. We expect more from our soldiers. I know some things have changed, but we certainly allow them. We do allow them to drink a couple of beer and have a bit of maturity when they're on missions. Americans don't. I mean, they have their operations are dry, and they don't trust their troops with alcohol. They treat them like prisoners. I mean, and you've seen that on U.S. Navy ships. I mean, sometimes those guys wearing their denims, I mean, it looks like they emptied out of jail. And these guys, I can remember seeing a passing of an admiral in one of the NATO fleet exercises there, coming from the American ship to the Canadian warship. And all the Canadians were turned out with their blue jackets on and, you know, piping them aboard, right? And all the Americans were hanging off their superstructure in their denims, yelling, "Yo, Admiral, see you later." They're all just, you know, up there. The Canadians were all lined up, I mean, as you expect from a British naval ship. Totally different standards. So, yeah, it's if they get loose, I think you've seen that too. If the Americans get on board a Canadian ship, they drink themselves blind. And the Canadians help them to do that. you're not guilty. You feed the youngest ones as much as they can drink. And we would see cases of that in Iraq when we traveled around. You'd find American soldiers who were drunk. I mean, staggeringly drunk. A, because they're afraid, and B, because they're demoralized. And the guy would say, like, I mean, there's rules against all this stuff. What are they going to do? I mean, if he's in jail, he's not getting shot at. So it's easier for him. If he's going to sit out 6 months of his tour in a jail inside the Green Zone, what difference is that if he's got to go out on a patrol where he might get killed? So it was very difficult for them over there. And morale is an issue, of course. But no, the Canadians do have a good reputation, particularly wherever they've been exposed to the people. In Afghanistan, it's a little different right now because they're not getting out as much. Obviously, it's another sort of Green Zone affair. Yeah?
I guess I have a little bit different view than the rest of you guys here. As a Bosnian from Bosnia and Bosnian Canadian, so I was there during the war for some time. So I was there when Serbs were bombarding. I was there when Muslim Croats were fighting in the street. Then I think that the very first part of your story I find very unilateral. I wonder how objective is that. Would your story be completely different if you had time to spend with Albanian family and with Albanian refugee instead of being on this side? I know there is, unfortunately, in this unfortunate war, all sides were, they lost. Incredible. I have experience from Bosnia. So I think even the first part of your story, I wonder how much objective and how much it's influenced where have you been during that period and what side.
I actually make a point of referring to it as the other side. I would be wrong to tell you that I've seen the whole thing. Nobody can see the whole thing. I make that quite clear. There is the story that's been told in mainstream media. There's the untold stories. There's always another side. There's always the Iraqi side. There's the insurgent side. You can take a side. You need to put them all together. And certainly we got bombarded with stories that were coming out of about the Albanians. I stayed with an Albanian family in Pristina. I wasn't in the hotel. So I did stay, and I've got stories, and I met with the Uchika. I got the armband to prove it, those guys that were taking us in. So yeah, as much as possible, I've crossed back and forth at great personal risk. When the Albanians were pushing in northern Macedonia, up around Tetovo, and that's in one of the other books there as well. I mean, I got taken by them and held for a while and got to meet and see them firsthand, see what they had, see that they had NATO maps. I mean, I got to see an awful lot of the support that we were giving them, which was, of course, never officially admitted to. So yeah, I mean, it's, of course, crossing back and forth. That's the new method of journalism. It's very rare. That's why so many people got killed in the Balkans.
It's very hard, really, to be objective. Of course, maybe I take that very emotionally. I think nobody from the region is without emotions, and there's a lot of post-traumatic stress syndrome that we all had. So I think, you know, I don't know, I believe that this story is true, that was like a fake mask burning, then it was actually some other buildings. But, you know, in Bosnia, there was hundreds and hundreds of mosques burned. Of course, there was some Orthodox church that were destroyed by Muslims.
Right, particularly Catholic church.
That happened. So, I mean, but I also find that first part of your talk is...
Well, okay, I also represent Canadian military, right, as a security corps. And when they did things that were untoward, which they did in Bosnia, we exposed that story as well. When our guys were having drunken fun with mental patients in Bakovici, we reported that too. Albeit that the government and the army wanted to keep their image pristine, that we were over there, you know, delivering aid and we were welcomed as heroes. Not everybody's a hero, and we reported that too. So at a cost to my magazine as well, and of course some people in the military would have much rather had that covered up. So no, you can't see everything, and you have to keep your mind open to what it is you are seeing. I mean, obviously the longer you spend in any one area, the more you get to get a feel for what's really being told. Very difficult to operate in northern Iraq. Talking to the various different witnesses and things, tough to get a feel for what happened after a suicide bomb, because you'll get stories that are so wildly opposed. I mean, one was 10 a.m., one was 10 p.m., one was 8 dead, one was no dead. Same incident, same scene, same supposed eyewitnesses. Normally you can draw a thread through and figure out that there's a couple dead and it happened roughly in the evening, but some of those things, after a while, you realize you just have to, it's a crapshoot, you can't get the thing down, and you need to report on the variance in the stories as opposed to try to determine what really happened. So again, it's the amount of experience you get in there. I was in Bosnia, not as much as Croatia and Kosovo and Serbia, of course, or Macedonia, but it was horrible what happened in that country. And the political machinations behind all that, and who was at play, I mean, how the people themselves were played and suffered the consequences, I mean, that's reflected on everybody. And that's where, I mean, people that should be being brought to justice aren't necessarily just the people on the ground, but the people that put those things into motion. So, yeah.
I would say, you know, NATO, or the 18 member nations of NATO, must have had a reason to take military action against Serbia to, in their view, protect the Kosovars. It might have been because of the increasing evidence that indeed those Serb security forces had recently pulled something like Srebrenica to say, you know, that's probably a good reason for NATO to take action. But you reject that. But then what in your view was NATO's or the member nations' motive in taking that action? It must have been driven by something.
Well, they had their plans and they had their motives, the different things that were going on. And I think NATO's up to like 26 countries now, is it not?
Yeah, but at the time we just enlarged.
It was 19, I think.
19.
Now, NATO almost came apart over that as well. A lot of the countries had their reservations about this. The Greeks were opposed to it. I mean, they have
voted in favor.
But also supplied, very little known about this, they supplied an army field hospital to treat Serbian wounded. Not too often in the history of warfare does an ally supply a hospital to help the people that they're inflicting the casualties upon. They did not support it. They voted for it, but they didn't support it. They did not put their troops on the ground, and the American embassy was assailed on a daily basis by angry Greeks, and they were furious with what was going on. The longer this thing went on, the Italians were having all kinds of issues about what was going on, what was happening in the region. And it was supposed to last 5 days. That was the plan. Everyone thought they would bomb for 5 days, Milosevic would capitulate, and they would get what they wanted. All the stuff, even all the ambassadors that were pulled out on the eve of the bombing, they booked hotel nights for 7 days in Budapest. Everyone sort of knew this was the plan. Obviously, we've got our contacts with our own Canadian planning sources. We dropped all of our smart bombs in the first 5 days, the ones that we bought, the guided missiles. We kept dropping bombs because the Americans gave us theirs, and we just paid for them after the war, to the tune of about $500 million. But we didn't, it's like lining up all your fireworks and you fire them off from the first minute it gets dark, when you got to keep borrowing more to keep on going. No, nobody expected it to be as long as it did, and it became problematic. If they had to put in a ground operation, I mean, that was another thing that they just weren't finding the support for within NATO. And in the end, it actually was a negotiated withdrawal, a negotiated settlement, which, if you look back at the previous agreements that they were putting on the table, the Serbs basically got all the things that they asked for. Once NATO got in, of course, they ripped up the agreement, and that's a dangerous precedent, by the way, that Resolution 1244, which allowed them to get in without fighting, they turned around and reneged on all the agreed upon statutes. Who's going to negotiate with NATO in good faith anymore?
But if we could return to the question.
They don't need it. It was the 50th anniversary of NATO, I believe.
Yeah.
The Soviet Union's gone. What's the relevance? And you can ask this question here today again. What's the relevance of being part of a NATO or a military alliance against who? Now that we're up to 26 countries and counting, what relevance does it have? They found that relevance by saying we need it for European security. It gave the Americans a continued relevance in Europe. Now that the Soviet Union's gone, why should they keep 300,000 soldiers stationed in Germany? Germans want them out. Now they got a whole chunk of them down in the Balkans.
Well, similarly, the people that are joining NATO, they're making it 26, are finding a relevance.
Economic relevance, sure. They're getting all kinds of promises made, and then they're finding out that it comes at a cost. Hungarians, I mean, they were anxious to join. They've joined. They wanted to buy Swedish fighter jets and turned around America and said, no, you'll take F-16s because you're part of NATO. Sweden's not, even though it's coming at a greater expense. I mean, it comes with a price. Canada doesn't always pay their full share of that price, mind you, but beyond buying military hardware on a joint basis, I think it's a stretch to say that we need a military alliance in this world of 20. 20-